interview with Debbie Yaffe. It's taking place on February 17 in Debbie's home, and it's a continuation of tape two. Debbie, we were talking about your teaching of lesbian studies at UVic, and you just finished talking about your first experience teaching lesbian studies with Michelle Pujol in 1994-95.
Yeah.
And then you said that there was a lapse of about 10 years.
There was about 10 years when there wasn't enough call for me to teach it. So Michelle taught it and Connie Carter taught it. So in the intervening 10 years, I wasn't paying that much attention to the theory so much. And then they asked me to teach it again because there was a need.
And that was...
But I think it must have been 2004 or 5. No, wait, it couldn't have been 5. I was gone. It must have been like 2002 or 3. Maybe 2003, let's say.
Okay.
So this was a big mistake on my part, because what I hadn't realized was that in the intervening years, a lot of the discourse on being a lesbian had completely changed, especially amongst the younger women. And I really wasn't aware of that. So whereas in the first class, I was able to make common cause with the lesbians on the grounds that we were all dykes together, and a kind of complicity in that. When I tried to do that in the second course, nobody wanted that, because the young women didn't identify as lesbians or even dykes. They identified as queer. And the grounds on which I was offering that kind of complicity didn't exist for them. Again, partly, it's an age thing. I'm sure I was that much older. I mean, I was born in 1943. They were born in maybe 83 or something. And it was partly that the dynamics around lesbian had changed so much in the 90s and early part of the 21st century. So that they didn't recognize the terms of reference that I was offering. It didn't resonate with them. They had, partly from our other courses in women's studies, they had a different analysis of sexuality, in which lesbianism was not as close to the center as it was for my analysis of feminism. It was much more just a civil rights, equal rights thing for them. They were way more taken up with gender issues in the sense of transgender issues. And queer gender issues than I was. And the class just did not work. And then there were a couple of severely, pathologically homophobic women in the class that I was unable to counter effectively because I didn't feel I had the backing of the lesbians. And I felt really like I was floundering, I was at sea, I didn't understand it, I didn't know what was wrong. And I sent emails out to everybody in the class. I sent an email out saying, what's wrong? I don't get it, I can see it's not working. You could, you know, stick an anonymous note under my door, come and see me, email me back, say it in class, I don't care, but let's try and fix this. Well, it was just a total disaster. Nobody really could give me effective information on what was wrong. And there are all kinds of dynamics going on between the students also that I wasn't party to. I mean, there always are. In a lesbian class, you know, everybody's sleeping with everybody and then, you know, getting mad and then, I have no idea. I let somebody in. I thought it was a trans kind of gender butchy woman, but turned out it was just a regular straight guy. I never should have let him in the class. it's funny. Anyway, all my preconceptions about what dyke students were like were wrong. It was just a disaster. It was a huge class. Way more people. Big disaster. And gender issues, the way they were confronting them, were never my personal issues in a way. Because I've never had any question that I was a woman. I definitely, when I was younger, felt like I wasn't feminine enough. You know, I had too much body hair, too much this, not enough breasts. Everything about me was not attractive in the way girls were supposed to be. I felt ugly and unfeminine, and felt like maybe I had a hormone imbalance. In fact, that phrase, hormone imbalance, still strikes me with a chill down my spine. But I never questioned that I was a girl. When I was little, I wanted to be a boy, only because boys had more freedom. You know, I wanted the freedom of boys, but I didn't literally want to be a boy. And of course, once I got into feminism, I just wanted to be with women, and the men's world lost interest. So anyway, I had no personal interest in gender the way these young people had a personal interest in gender. And I didn't have the intellectual background, because I hadn't done the reading, to see how that had changed the way the way younger women thought about being lesbians, and even feminists. Because now a lot of the readings were about how feminism was this no fun, no sex, anti-transgendered, you know, transphobic, very oppressive force. And some of the writings were challenging, you know, lesbian feminist icons like the Michigan Women's Festival as being exclusive, anti-trans. That whole thing of transphobia became a big issue. I was so unprepared. So I had to do a lot of reading, because then I had to teach in the next term as well. So I did a lot of reading in a short period of time, completely reconfigured the course and my thinking. And because the class had been such a disaster, the next class was very small. There was only about 14, which made it way easier. And it was a really great class. Really enjoyed it. And made some friends that I still have. We had some very smart people. We had no nutcases, that helps.
How did you reconfigure it? And in the class, as you presented it the second time, did you feel it was, I don't know how to say this, authentically presented? Was it what you wanted to be teaching?
Well, what I found was I had to teach women's studies in general, I would say, my last couple of years. And I think I finished teaching in 2004. I found that I couldn't really teach what was close to my heart. It just didn't work in that program anymore. But I found that I could teach from my head. I could teach it so that it was intellectually satisfying, and that it worked in the classroom. But I found that the students, I think actually, in our program as a whole, were being fed a much more coherent that is all going in the same direction line than they had before. Everybody was teaching the same ideology. And that my heart ideology was not in that framework, so I couldn't really teach it. So I had to go with what fit in that ideology. And that worked better. And intellectually, it was interesting for me. But it was not the lesbianism of my life. It's not the way I or my friends or the people I knew or the books that I was interested in were set up. But I think that's okay because I was teaching them, I wasn't teaching me. Mm-hmm. But again, there was much more of a divergence by that time between their interests and mine. So I had to teach to their interests.
Now you've mentioned some of the interests in the lesbian, the divergent interests in the lesbian course because of queer theory. With regard to feminist theory, what were the changes that you perceived going on?
Okay, this is going to be harder for me to reconstruct, I think, because I think a lot of it's gone from my hard drive. The feminist theory that was being taught in the women's studies department later on, number one, was much more theoretical and not experientially based. Number two, it was much more, and this is a good thing, you know, what we call intersectional, in which sexuality and gender and class and racialized position and geography and everything, they're all woven together into a whole. They're not looked at separately so much. And again, I think this is very good, but it made the theory change. You couldn't put everything else on hold in quite the same way and just look at one or two aspects. And sexuality, I think students started to see sexuality as a much more individualized thing, and it's coming back now. One of the things that changed was the way students saw a politicized way of looking at sexuality, and a politicized way, particularly, of looking at lesbian sexuality. Because for me and my generation of feminists, the politicized way of looking at sexuality was key in understanding our sexuality, understanding how it played out with women, with men, and key in freeing it up and in doing battle with the sexist elements that we were all brought up with. It felt like a freeing of possibility for the students who were mainly by now reading pieces that were critical of a politicized look at sexuality. They saw feminist sexuality, or feminist sexual critiques, as policing and as being restrictive and as imposing dominant feminist orthodoxy onto women who saw themselves as outlaws. The whole sexual outlaw, remember that phrase, my God, in the kind of the 90s was, and the kind of sexual radicals, sex radicals. Women who, like Gail Rubin, who had moved from a classic second wave position to what she called a sex radical position, in which, to my way of seeing, it was important that other feminists were saying, you shouldn't do that, to give the sex radicals a feeling that they were doing something forbidden. The idea of transgressing boundaries seemed to be really big. And traditional feminist analyses of sexuality and politicized ways of looking at sexuality were seen as trying to prevent transgressive, radical sexual behavior and trying to police the boundaries. And the whole idea of boundaries came under greater critique. This is partly from the sex radicals, it's partly from the postmodernists, for whom boundaries and binary, you know, it's bad. It came from a variety of directions. It came from a lot of, not just theory, but like street level, queer, young people who were challenging class, who were challenging orthodoxies, the whole, you know, the pierced, tattooed, gender-fucking kind of street-level activists were challenging feminist politicized ways of looking at sexuality. And I think some of that is good. You know, it's good to get your ideas kicked around. But the fact is, for me personally, the feminist critiques work, and the sex radical thing just seems silly to me. And it does seem to me very much to depend on somebody else's disapproval. It seems very adolescent to me. Why would I give a shit when anybody else does it bad, unless they're doing it to me? You know, really, it's it was setting us up to be these policemen, I guess, in a way. So that sex radical critique, actually, when I think of it, that was there in the earlier lesbian class as well. And the whole thing about power in sex, that was coming. Gosh, I'm remembering this woman, Mary Scanlon, who gave her class presentation, her final presentation, in a red leather bra and not much else. She since died of breast cancer. It's just sad. That whole kind of S&M thing, that was actually prominent in the first lesbian class. I do remember that. But it didn't, it was just part of what made the class interesting and fun. So by the second one, it was much more, these are queer kids, you know, they're just not interested so much in feminist sexual critiques as a political way of looking. The idea that somebody is thinking about sexual behavior, they just didn't see it in a liberatory way. It just seemed repressive to them. It's our ground box. It's okay.
Okay. I think you've really covered my next question in the questions that Nan had suggested that I ask, but just let me read you the question and see if there's anything you'd like to add to it. It says, you mentioned that you came to feminism out of the radical left and through the women's liberation movement, which gave you the perspective of wanting to change society fundamentally, rather than just enlarging the opportunities for women and for lesbians within the existing society. And in that way, I think you reflect the attitude of the late Jane Rule, who, for instance, believed that same-sex couples should help to liberate heterosexual couples from the strictures of marriage rather than joining them in that institution. How have you structured your own life in accordance with your beliefs? You've talked a little about that.
Oh, God. Well, you know, the funny thing is, I think I lead this totally conservative life. And since being a lesbian, I mean, number one, I was teaching at the university So for the first time in my life, I had money of my own, a lot of money. Donna and I, when we started living together, we bought this house. So I was a house owner. I had a fancy professional job. I felt really disoriented at being such a solid citizen. And really, I still am. I mean, I'm a retired elderly lady. What can I say? It's funny that what was seen by some women as this necessarily radical step of, you could say, well, I left a marriage, I became a lesbian, I made my life with women. Sounds radical, but in fact, it's coincided with the least radical part of my life. And my politics, my political analysis is still strong, but I don't do that much anymore. Partly there's not that much that interests me to do, just because the activist scene seems boring mostly, or it's just not my scene. Mm-hmm. Partly I'm older and tireder. Partly I'm really comfortable and happy. And having maybe more money, you know, I write checks. I've become what I always despised, you know, and I'm the sort of person, I mean, you know, it's like, well, I spent so much money on my traveling last year, I can't afford to give more than a small amount to this organization or that. You know, I'm this middle class, middle-aged, perfectly satisfied, disgusting person. And, teaching was fun, but it's basically just my job. Mm-hmm. I always just felt I'm only here for the money. I didn't feel like it was my political work. Some people do. I never felt it was my political work. I felt it was my job, my paid work. And I stayed active in every woman's books until it finished. I've done other political stuff. I'm kind of a groupie. I like groups. It's kind of an efficient way to see my friends, and I still feel collected about those things. So I've started groups. I've done other political work. I still would happily do political work if I thought that there was something really passionately involving that I really felt like doing. Mm-hmm. But we just lead this totally ordinary life. And when I first moved in with Donna, I did have these fears about our neighbors, but we're just the girls, you know, our neighbors are totally cool with us. We walk down the street, there's no problem holding hands. When we were together 20 years, we went into a... Maybe I told you this story.
You told me the story about the rings, yeah.
Yeah, and just never even... I never once think that my life is going to be in danger in Victoria, mm-hmm. because I'm a lesbian. I was always out at university. Every class I taught, I was always out. I spoke at lots of rallies and this, that, and the other. I was always out. I never felt, I certainly don't now feel at all targeted as a lesbian. Or it just seems to have become harmless. And I think it's a shame in a way. I mean, it's pleasant. It's easier to live. But I do feel like we've lost something. And just like there used to be lesbian events, social events, political things kind of out there in the world. And there's dances, but there's nothing ongoing. There's not a club. There's not a place to have meetings.
Speakers.
Speakers. Nobody brings in readers so much. Even when I was at UVic, that was one of my favorite things. I could bring in lesbian authors. Using the university's money and auspices. That was so great. I loved it. So I don't have those resources anymore either. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of the best things about working at the university. I had tremendous resources at my disposition, and they gave me money to buy books. It's fabulous. You know, you get a professional development allowance. So
Oh, for yourself?
For myself, yeah. Oh, wow. I had like $1,000 a year to buy books. It was just amazing.
Heaven.
Yeah. So now I have to go to the library. I don't buy books anymore.
Now, so you've talked about the fact that you're retired now, and not just from your job, but pretty much also from activism. Mm-hmm. So I'd like you to think about your life and answer a few questions about it. You've mentioned feeling astonished by your perception that the women's movement and all that it stood for seems to be disappearing in a way, as if it never were. I don't think you talked about that on tape, but I think I've heard you say that socially.
Yeah.
So would you talk a little bit about that and your feelings about it?
Well, it's just so interesting that, I just always expected that there would be this feminist revolution. And failing that, up until, there would certainly be an active, vibrant women's liberation movement. I never doubted that. I could see after about 1989 that it was changing and that it was maybe not as exciting and fun as it had been. And there's a lot of acrimony. I could certainly see that rather than these big global organizations and women all over the world, women were organizing much more separately. But I just assumed that there would always be a women's liberation movement. But what I see is that, partly because of changes in our culture and this kind of individualization of everything, that feminist issues in the popular media have been very individualized. It's just each woman has to choose for herself what kind of work she should have, how she should look, what kind of partner she wants. And somehow that choice has been seen as the hallmark of feminism. And that whole thing about choice has just been completely subverted and co-opted. And, I mean, it comes back to the abortion rights, when it was too contentious to talk about abortion rights. And we started talking about choice. Well, everybody could understand choice, and that's when people got on side. But it was co-opted as a kind of commercialized consumer's choice. As long as you can buy 18 different kinds of toothpaste at 3 in the morning, 7 days a week, you're free. Mm-hmm. And that's what's kind of got out there. So it's women partly have seen less need to join together with other women to take collective action. The CR groups transmogrified into book groups, as far as I can see, which are marvelous and wonderful, but they don't have that component of you do all this talking and then you take action based on your collective understandings. That's just been conveniently dropped. Without consciousness raising and with this emphasis on individuality, then women, I think, right back to how I was brought up, still think that everything that doesn't work in their life is somehow their own fault. They haven't got the right fitness program, they haven't got the right CV, they're the woman who loves too much. All these self-help, this enormous proliferation of self-help books has blossomed in the same time frame. So it's all self stuff. And the answer is take up yoga. The answer is take up something. It's never a collective action.
Change society.
It's never change society. It's get your breasts augmented. It's get your nose fixed. It's get Botox, you know. And again, the whole, I'm rambling here, but the whole gender focus on sex change as a way of ameliorating the gender issues around being a butch lesbian is stunning to me. I cannot look at trans sexual operations and medical procedures outside the context of the medicalization of gender stuff anyway. You're unhappy with the way your body does your gender? Fix it. It's all become individual plastic surgery. So, you know, I just see that as a general cultural theme right now. I never thought that kind of individualism would supplant the women's movement in the way that it has. Having said that, there are pockets of women's movement activism all over the place. There are women doing things that it doesn't necessarily look like my feminism, but it's their feminism. And even classic radical feminist theory says you have to make feminism out of your life. They can't make it out of my experiences. Younger women, they have to make it out of their own experiences. Mm-hmm. And their experience arts are they're growing up with, you know, a whole different set of things being normalized. So part of me has this tremendous optimism that out of their own experiences, they will see that they need to do something more than just change themselves. And that they will organize on their own. And I actually get a newsletter from England, this one that's still photocopied, called the Older Feminist Network newsletter. And there was something in the last issue about 600 women in London organizing a London feminist network, and women in Glasgow and women in Bristol, I think, in various cities and around Britain organizing feminist networks. I perked up, you know. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to happen because the fact is you cannot make your life better only working on your personal stuff, because it doesn't change the structures. It just changes how you are in those structures. And women aren't stupid. No, you know, people aren't stupid. They will eventually figure it out, just like we did.
Again.
And it's not really reinventing the wheel, because it's never quite the same wheel. Mm-hmm. And I know that for me, when I was growing up, I looked back at things that feminists had done with the most profound boredom and lack of interest. It seemed to have nothing to do with me. So I'm assuming that, you know, it'll happen again, that they'll go from being totally bored with me and my feminism to creating one of their own. And that's just how it is. I mean, I never would have thought there'd be a world without a Soviet Union, for example. I mean, that was just a given, a taken for granted. I never thought there'd be a world in which socialism was just written off as a failed experiment. Because in the 60s, you know, that was where everybody was heading. What I see now is that if you live long enough, the wheel turns, you come round, but it's a spiral. It's not the same wheel. Because there are resources there if people start to look for them. I mean, even if this goes to the Women's Movement Archive, that's one of the reasons I was so keen to start the archive, is that nobody knows about all this rich women's movement organizing there was in Victoria. And there was an amazing amount of women's movement organizing here.
When did the archive get started, and how did that come about?
It started in this century, for sure. It was before I stopped working, but not a whole lot before. My friend Susan Moger and I were talking one day just about, I don't know, probably about things being lost. Susan was quite active in the 80s and before, but here I knew her in the 80s and 90s. And we were talking about things being lost, and I think we just got the idea. And so I went and talked to the archivist. I was afraid she'd say, don't be silly, but she was very, very interested. So Susan and the archivist at the time and I formed a committee, and we started the Women's Movement Archives here in the university, because I was very concerned that everything's getting lost, the papers are getting lost. And maybe the fact that SWAG was closing down, because SWAG was quite a repository. So we just started checking with women's organizations and with the women we knew, just putting the word out. And we've got tons of stuff up there, and started helping them catalog it. And it's really fun for us when we go up there. Sometimes we'll get a call, there's a new batch of stuff, and we go and sort out, well, what's worth keeping, what's not. Just brings all this stuff back. So there's all these posters and newsletters and one-off things and all kinds of stuff. It's just, I guess for me what's wonderful is to see, you know, how history's a river and you're just always swimming in it. I get very moved. Because I never thought of that. You know, it's not like you just live and you die and that's it. But there are all these connections, and you are always in history, and you're always part of it. I never had any interest in history until I got old. Mm-hmm. And you see, and I think that so many of us think, oh, it's just this old thing, it's not worth keeping. But it's precious, and our lives are precious, you know? And I'm the opposite of a pack rat. I throw things out left, right, and center. I say, ugh, it's not worth keeping. Ugh. Not that person's lover anymore. I'm not going to keep their letters, you know? I throw out everything. But I see that everything we did was so important to keep and to date. We never put the years on anything because we took it for granted. Everybody would know what year it was. We were in that year. And for me, that's such a little metaphor, you know. We've had rich lives. I mean, they still are, but there was this real special richness of organizing and living. I mean, our life was our political work. It wasn't separate. Mm-hmm. And I want younger women to know that, you know, that it existed. It still exists, because we're not gone. We're still here. We still carry that. So that's been one of my favorite things. And one of the few ongoing things I've committed to in retirement. I'm quite happy to take on projects that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Short-term things. But I won't sit on anybody's board. I won't mm-hmm. do stuff like that. I just don't want to clutter my life.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give you an opportunity just to make any last comments you might have, but I think we've really gotten to a point where we're talking about a real summing up.
You know, you feel like we're going to die. And it does give it all a point. I mean, like, death is more of a reality. I mean, it's always a reality, but I'm old enough that it is a reality. Mm-hmm. It does lend a poignance to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I think we lived in wonderful times. And I'm really glad. And I'd love to live long enough to see it all come back again. That's I have hopes. I do have hopes. Especially that people should have more of a collective understanding of how things work and their place in it, and to get away from the atomized, privatized way of living. I hope it's not too long before everybody doesn't go around with their iPods and their MP3s and everything's plugged in. It just cuts you off so much. I mean, maybe if I'd grown up being used to it, I wouldn't mind it, but It does seem a very lonely way to live. And to think that you're sitting there at your computer typing and that's somehow being with somebody, it just seems bizarre. The wheel will turn. And, I don't know. It's been great. And I do think they should teach history differently from grade one and really teach it as a living thing that's part of our lives all the time. I mean, it's funny that we say, oh, that's history, as a put-down. That's capitalist values, you know. You have to have something new all the time. You have to be able to buy the newest thing and to disparage what was already there. That's crap.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll just let that's crap be my last word.
Okay.